You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 25th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, guys, by now you have all seen the movie Hidden Figures. Mm-hmm. So I thought, hey, let's review it. It's kind of like a forgotten superhero of science, right, Bob?
Yeah, I actually covered them, I think, earlier in 2016, didn't I?
Yeah.
I definitely covered them. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was really, really happy that they made a movie with these three. And I thought it was wonderful. I just thoroughly enjoyed it. And moving in parts, too.
So this is a movie about the Mercury program, NASA's Mercury program, but focusing on three women, Mary Jackson, Katherine Johnson, and Dorothy Vaughan, who were computers. They used the term computer to refer to mostly women who would do mathematical computations, right? That's what they did, because this is prior to electronic computers. So they would do things like calculate orbits. They were critical to the space program at that time, and yet they were largely unsung, you know, contributors to the space program. And the movie Hidden Figures essentially seeks to correct that omission.
Yeah, they, you know, this was actually before NASA. It was called NACA, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, when it first happened. And at Langley, which is the campus where they worked, it was segregated, much like everything else in the South. And so these women actually worked in West Computing, which was a whole separate building with separate bathrooms and separate facilities. Everybody in West Computing was African American. These were some of the earliest open positions for African American women to be working in kind of a mathematical or engineering capacity. And there were people on campus at Langley at the time who didn't even know West Computing existed. Mm-hmm. They were very hidden even within their own campus, which is pretty crazy because especially these three women, but many more, made incredible contributions to science, to engineering, both to the space program, but also to computer programming, to reading Fortran, you know, programming the first mainframe computers. Just incredible.
Engineering.
Yeah, I think the thing that bummed me out the most about the movie is that they didn't get to really expand on how incredible these women really were. It's like they showed a snippet of time, which I know is all you can really do with a movie, but each one of these three main characters could have had their own movie in their own right.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah, it's important to remember, I think, as well, that you know this movie was based on a 55-page proposal for the book. So the book was finished while production was already well underway.
So
that would explain some of the movie's deviations, because it wasn't fully fleshed out when they had when it was being recorded. Sure, they could have talked to the book's author.
They did,
for sure.
She was available. Shetley.
Yeah, she definitely was available. Yeah. So they could have, they used her more for input. But a lot of the main stuff was there. I mean, I looked at what these women actually did do in reality. And so for Katherine Johnson, she was three decades at NASA or initially NACA. And she did calculate the trajectory for Alan Shepard's first American in space. And the calculations for John Glenn's first orbit were verified by Katherine. And let's see, she also computed the trajectory of Apollo 12's flight to the moon. Awesome.
Nice.
And get this, she also worked on the famous plan that saved Apollo 13's crew. She was actually in that mix, which I wasn't aware of.
Oh, and by the way, she's still with us.
She's alive.
YouTube interviews with Katherine Johnson, and she is awesome. She's like hilarious in her interviews. It's definitely worthwhile to start reading up on her and looking at some of her recent modern interviews.
Yeah, she's 99 years old this year.
Yeah, and she's sharp as a tack and funny.
Yeah,
she has.
Awesome.
I have an interesting quote from her regarding segregation. She asked whether she felt the segregation of the outside world while within NASA, and she said no. Essentially, she said, "I didn't feel the segregation at NASA because everybody there was doing research. You had a mission, and you worked on it, and it was important for you to do your job and play bridge at lunch. I didn't feel any segregation. I knew it was there, but I didn't feel it, she said. Okay. So that's definitely a bit of a different thing. I mean, you know, nobody thought she was a janitor on her first day of the job. I mean, and that's fine. It was an interesting scene in the movie, but I mean, you don't, those little things basically, like a lot of the actors, a lot of the characters in the movie didn't really exist. They're kind of amalgams and kind of giving you a sense for what common attitudes were and common perceptions. And that's fine.
Yeah.
And that's totally fine.
Yeah.
Let me jump to Dorothy Vaughn real quick. She became NACA's first black supervisor in 48, which is earlier. This is 5 years before Katherine Johnson started even working there, so they weren't really necessarily contemporaries as much as they were in the movie. Vaughn was an advocate and a representative of sorts for the women in the West Computers Pool, so that was true. Mary Jackson, she was really NASA's first African-American female engineer. And also a senior aeronautical research engineer did encourage her to pursue an engineering degree, as in the movie, and she did take graduate courses that required her to petition the city of Hampton to be able to work, to go to classes along with her white peers. So that was also true, which was a fantastic scene. That scene in the movie when she goes to the court and plays that judge perfectly.
Yeah,
she
came,
that scene, I was almost moved to tears. It was just so beautifully effective. She did her homework. She played it as sharp as that could have been played. And I'm sure it's very different from what really happened. But that just that one scene in the movie, I fucking loved it.
So actually, later in her career, she became a very important advocate for other women, advising them on how to advance their career. Because often, like, they were just missing one course that they would have needed in order to get a job or get a degree that they needed. And so she did it for herself, and then she helped other women do the same thing after her.
In order to do that, she actually took a demotion. Like, you know, she was working as a senior engineer. She had the most senior title as an engineer, and she actually left that post in order to work for, like, the Office of Equal Opportunity Programs, which was a more administrative role, which was actually, like, paid her less money and gave her a lower title. But it was worth it at that point in her career because she thought she was doing more good, which I think is super cool.
So I did a lot of research to try to find how accurate the movie was.
Oh, interesting.
To real history. Just address that question. Mm-hmm. So, of course, you know, the director says this is not a documentary. You know, there are demands of storytelling. So typically what movies do when they quote-unquote Hollywoodize a historical episode is they decrease the number of characters in the movie because you can't – you know, the audience would get lost if they had to keep track of a lot of different characters. They often do combine characters, like two or three people, into one person who does everything. So
they did that in the Turing movie. Remember the Bletchley Park movie?
Yeah.
There was one woman when there were like thousands of women at Bletchley Park.
So they have like sort of representative characters who do all the things, you know, that those characters did. So here's a good quote from the author, Shetterly. She said, "Even though Katherine Johnson in this role was a hero, there were so many others that were required to do other kinds of tests and checks to make Glenn's mission come to fruition. But I understand you can't make a movie with 300 characters. It is simply not possible. Unless, of course, that movie is 300. And you can have 300 characters. So the other thing that they do is they take action that historically occurred over decades and make it happen in 2 years. They compress the time frame over. So, and that's, again, you see, you know, look at Hollywood movies of historical events. It's like everything's happening at once to a few characters, you know, but it's never how things played out in reality. They were happening over much longer periods of time to many different people. But you know, anyway, so most of the inaccuracy was due to those things, which are forgivable because they're necessary for storytelling. But pretty much other than that, it was praised as being highly accurate. In fact, Johnson herself saw the movie and said it was great. She loved it. She thought
that's probably the highest praise you could ask for.
Oh, sure,
exactly.
Yeah,
she said that's what it was like. Said that. So the essentially the filmmakers tried to capture the feel and the essence of what happened, even though they know they can't, you know, they don't have the time in a 2-hour movie or whatever to portray it in detail. You have to, you know, simplify it in a lot of ways.
Steve, would you say in your research that NASA's, the way that they treated them, the mathematicians, was accurate? You know, when I was watching it thinking, you know, were they that kind, or was that them trying to make a point in the movie?
So, I mean, in terms of eventually coming around and saying, right. you know, so absolutely. I mean, it was a total meritocracy. What everyone said was as soon as the Soviets put up the first satellite, everything changed, right? Mm-hmm. And that it was all about getting the job done and everyone was pulling together. It didn't matter who you were. All that mattered was, are you pushing the ball forward?
And it was very soon after that NACA became NASA. And with that executive order, in 58, with that executive order or whatever the legislation was that changed it into NASA, they desegregated. NASA has always been desegregated. It's when it was NACA. Yeah.
That's correct. And also, I think around the same time, the military in general was desegregated. So NASA came along with that.
Makes sense. The two go
obviously, there were racist people everywhere. I mean, that's never going to change.
1960s,
But the administration was working really hard to kind of make it as level as possible. I'm really lucky, you guys. So I got the opportunity to work with IBM on an app. It was called Outthink Hidden, and you can download it like anytime you want. And it's an app for the Hidden Figures film, and it's sort of an augmented reality app. So what you do is anywhere in your area, there are quote unquote statues of 10 hidden figures. So these three women and also seven more really cool women and a couple of men, African-American men from history. And you go up to the statue, and with your headphones on, once you can see it on your phone, then you can listen to like a 2-minute biography of them. And that's my voice in the biography.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So it was really fun. And I got to really dig deep and study each of these individuals because we wanted to make sure the biographies were really historically accurate. Mm-hmm. They're also reflected in Wikipedia. Sort of the project was that IBM said, let's find 10 really interesting historical figures who are quote unquote hidden, who don't have a Wikipedia page or their Wikipedia page is really insufficient to tell their story. And let's do a bunch of historical research, hire a bunch of historians, and then update their Wikipedias to reflect what they actually offered. And
nice
then
idea.
We'll do
very
this app
nice
out
idea.
Of it. It was very cool. So I feel like I have kind of a tenuous connection to the movie, but I feel really lucky
yeah, that's cool.
in that regard. Yeah.
That is cool. So, yeah, there's a lot of discussion about how did it portray the attitudes, you know, towards both, you know, sexism and racism in the movie. And a lot of people thought it was pretty fair. Again, it's just trying to capture more archetypes than any real people, you know, what they actually did. I thought just watching the movie, some of the characters were really subtle. Like the Kirsten Dunst character, I thought was one of the most subtle characters in the movie.
It was a nice job. She did a nice job.
She's such a good actress.
She did a great job because she, you know, the character was a good person who actually thought of themselves as a good person, and clearly she didn't think she was racist. But she, by modern standards, she was totally racist.
Absolutely.
And didn't she even say something towards the end, like, "I just want you to know that I'm not racist."
Right.
You know, whatever she said.
She said,
like, "I know you think that."
Yeah. So Kirsten Dunst's character said, I just want you to know I have nothing against you.
Yes, that's what she said.
And then Vaughn said, I believe that you believe that. You know?
Yes.
Which was the perfect response. Like, you don't think you're a racist, but it's so implicit in everything that you do and say, you don't even realize it. And of course, 1960s, it was just so baked into the culture. You know, that felt very believable, you know, to me, that kind of interaction.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think she represented like a baseline of where a lot of people were at the time.
Yeah.
Societal norm for as normal
and it became,
as it was.
You know, she was in the position where she was kind of forced to get to know these people, and it took time, but she seemed to come around, you know, to a certain degree. I thought that was, you know, interesting as well.
Yeah, there was growth. The characters had an arc, which is always good.
I liked how the movie's focus wasn't on really the racism, right? It was I appreciated the fact that we got to understand their achievements. I thought it was just subtle. Like, it wasn't like them fighting back, and they didn't do the thing that you would expect them to do where they over-dramatize things. They really didn't go there. Like, I expected there to be a lot more, I don't know how to put it. Like, there was quite a bit of racism in the movie, but as the movie, you know, progressed, it became more about the fact that these were just successful and brilliant people.
On a mission, on a specific mission to get something done.
It's a delicate balance, and you know, it's a lot of personal choice there. You could certainly question whether or not they hit you over the head a little bit too heavy with the themes of the movie. I mean, it was
Yeah, it's a little, I think it's a little on the nose and it's a little saccharine for my taste. It's a little sanitized, but
it was definitely sanitized.
Yeah. It just kind of feels like a Disney movie, you know, but I do appreciate, and nothing against Disney, I love Disney, but it feels like it's very much a family movie. And maybe that's why, you know, because they want young women to be able to go and see these incredible figures, and they don't want there to be like strong racial epithets or anything where they would have to give it a higher rating. Right. So I kind of, I guess I get that approach, but something about that was a little kind of unnerving for me because I sort of felt like it all seemed a bit too easy in the movie.
Yeah, I guess I see that. I could,
you know,
see
what
that.
I mean?
Yeah,
it's a fine line. It's a fine line.
Yeah, I think that's another stylistic choice that a director would make. Like, how inspirational versus gritty do you want to make the movie? And this was definitely way towards the inspirational end of the spectrum, which, you know what, a movie about NASA and science and how awesome it is and how people, you know, were valued for the fact that they were smart and they were like that. Another great line. It's like, yeah, they Johnson was saying to her, I think her future husband, that they like us not because we wear skirts, but because we wear glasses.
Yeah. You know,
because we're smart. That's, we're there because we are smart. And any movie that celebrates that, thumbs up for me. And I'll tolerate a little bit of cheesiness.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't think they overdid it, but it was definitely towards that end of the spectrum. You just have to sort of expect that going in. But that's kind of, it's also the same thing. Again, this movie has to get compared to The Right Stuff, right?
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah. And the truth is, that's a good family movie. I don't think about it because I don't have kids. So when I'm watching a movie, I'm just thinking about how I react to it. But I'll tell you what, a movie about black women doing math that blew everything else out of the box office opening
week. Not your typical
week,
thing, right?
That is incredible. Epic. It was number one at the box office, and it's still going really strong. It's got all these great nominations. It's about black women doing math.
Doing
like
science,
just let that sink in. It's amazing.
No, absolutely.
If you predicted that last year, I might have laughed at it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Like, it flies in the face of every trope. It's incredible that it's doing as well as it is, because I think it just shows that, again, people appreciate the inspiration and people are proud of their heritage. They're proud of science. They're proud of education. And if you play to that, if you don't just expect that people wouldn't watch a movie like that and never make it, you're really doing people a disservice.
Mm-hmm. Plus, I think a lot of people are listening to and appreciating Superheroes of Science.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
That must be why.
That was the inspiration.
It's quite plain that Bob Segment inspired the entire movie.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
No question.
No brainer.
Yeah. If you deny that, that's fake news. You're lying. That's right. You're biased.
Lies and lies.
And by the way, this is obviously a movie review that we're doing on SGU, but oftentimes we do movie reviews because everybody has a chance to see a movie and it's easy to, you know, to get a hold of it or to go to the theater. But if you have the time and the inclination, read the book. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's much more accurate, much more detailed, obviously much longer. The movie was really just a taste of what's in the book.
Here's one thing I was most happy to find out really, really did happen. John Glenn really did ask that Catherine double check the computer's calculations, the electronic computer's calculations for his first Earth orbit. That made me very happy that really did happen.
Yeah, that's super cool.
That was a transcript. That was like literally a transcript of what he actually said in real life.
Oh, I love
awesome.
That.
John Glenn, so cool. Good man.
Although a lot of people pointed out that he referred to her as that girl, which was, you know, by today's standards, is a little bit condescending or a little bit sexist. But I think it showed he was a good guy. And, you know, he appreciated her talents and her ability, but it was still tainted by just a little bit of the attitudes of the time. You know,
which you can't
get away from, right? I mean, that's, you know.
Well, and also you've got to think of it. He's one of the guys up in the ship, and he has hundreds of people on staff helping to get him up in the ship. So, of course, it's that guy and this girl. Like, you know, kind of got to give it a grain of salt with that, too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, from what I read, he personally requested her. I mean, not just any computer, but
oh, yeah, her.
But her.
The same one who did the calculations for Shepard. Yeah, she wanted her.
Right, just to make that clear.
Yep, Catherine Johnson, yeah.
So when I was researching how historically accurate Hidden Figures was, I got sidetracked into looking up how historically accurate The Right Stuff was. Because again, it's the comparison mm-hmm. to that movie. Because it's the same time period. It's the Mercury program. It's just focusing on different people. It's also, from what I've just read, there's only really been two major films to feature John Glenn as a character. And these are the two. The Right Stuff and Hidden mm-hmm. Figures. But in any case, so The Right Stuff, all the similar kind of things, it kind of combined characters and sacrificed some accuracy for the sake of story. But there was one thing that people are most upset about that The Right Stuff got wrong. Do you guys know have any idea what that is?
They got a lot of things wrong, but I don't know what the most popular one or the most hated one is.
So there's a lot of pedantic things they got wrong. You start reading people, oh, that wasn't a McDonnell Douglas ship. That was this kind. Well, who cares, right? There's a lot of things like that, but little, very technical things. And then some people are saying, oh, the chatter on the radio was a little inaccurate. Yeah, okay. If you're an expert, you're going to totally pick apart the details. But there was one plot element, like big, broad brushstroke plot element that really made people upset. And that was how they portrayed Gus Grissom and the blown hatch.
Oh, okay.
You guys remember that?
Oh, yeah.
I remember his portrayal in the movie as they kind of portrayed him as a shifty kind of take advantage guy.
That he did it, that he blew the hatch on the Liberty Bell 7. So soon after splashdown on the Liberty Bell 7, which was the capsule that Grissom was in, this was the second U.S. manned space flight. And, he was going through his checklist and he was supposed to wait until the helicopter latched on to the capsule.
Right.
And then the hatch would blow by itself. I mean, there was a procedure by which, like, when it started getting lifted out of the water, that should have triggered the hatch to blow. But the hatch blew prematurely. And as soon as it did, the capsule started taking on water. Grissom had to quickly evacuate the capsule, and he almost drowned.
Yeah, he almost lost it there.
His suit started filling up with water, not as quickly as it could have because his neck was sealed, fortunately, but he did have openings. So he started to fill up with water. He almost drowned, but a second copter rescued him. But they lost the Liberty Bell 7. That wasn't recovered for like 38 years later or something. They recovered that from the Atlantic. But the thing is, the movie portrayed it as if Grissom was essentially guilty, that he blew the hatch. He panicked, he blew the hatch, and then he lied about it later. But the verdict of looking at all the data is that that's not what happened.
Interesting.
That the hatch really did blow by itself, that he couldn't really have blown the hatch. Later missions with the similar setup showed that, in order to manually blow the hatch, he would have bruised his hand. It was that hard to do it manually. And,
oh, wow.
And he had a thorough medical exam after the mission and he didn't have any similar bruises. So that's one piece of evidence. Also they said that, Grissom was one of the most professional of the seven Mercury astronauts and he flew a flawless mission. His mission was flawless and he did a great job. And it was totally bogus to blame him for blowing that hatch.
That sucks.
Yeah, that does suck. That was just manufactured drama for the film.
It was manufactured drama. No, I mean, they didn't make up this idea that he blew the hatch. That was a legitimate controversy at the time.
Gotcha.
But they went with the he blew the hatch narrative when in fact
the
evidence,
they didn't correct it.
The judgment was clearly that he did not. He was innocent.
And in a way, they kind of rewrote history by doing
that. They did.
It's so effective, especially in film. That's why it must be so much pressure when you're a director or an executive producer trying to do a biographical film of an actual event or an actual person and making the decisions about what license to take and where you need to be true to history.
Right.
What a smack in the face that must have been to, friends and family.
Yeah. And of course he was dead, so he couldn't say anything about it.
But like to his kids,
As a fan of the space missions and all the efforts that go into to do this for as long as the United States has been doing it. I grew up with this stuff.
Yeah.
To me, there is something epically badass about the Mercury missions and what they represented.
Yeah, love it.
Oh, gosh. They were forging a new frontier, basically.
Yeah, like those astronauts were told specifically, this is unbelievably dangerous. Like,
Of
course, we want you to survive. But they knew that it was deadly. And they did it with such, robust love for what they were doing, and that they were able to keep their cool. You know, they were able to do things that I find moderately superhuman. You know, I know I shouldn't use that word loosely, but they were so good about it, and they were so authentic with what was going on. And on top of that, I just don't think there's a cooler spacesuit ever. Like, seriously, take a look at the images of them standing together and some of the hero shots that were taken.
They're very cool.
Yeah, there is something like
it's because they're like silver, right? There's like a cool, like, it's very retro in the best possible way.
Yeah, they are. They're exactly. Totally cool. I agree.
To me,
yeah.
That's a spaceman. That is like an astronaut slash spaceman. That's what's in my mind when I think about things like that.
One final anecdote before we move on to some news items. My daughter saw the movie with her friend. They're both nerds. And during the sequence towards the end of the movie when John Glenn is flying, the movie made it really suspenseful, you know, because was John Glenn going to make it back okay or not? You know, and of course, Julia's friend is like sitting there biting her nails, totally anxious, like, oh, I'm so worried for John Glenn. She's like, dude. He died like 3 weeks ago.
You know how this turns out.
Right? But they did do a good job of making it suspenseful, even though you knew what was going to happen.
Yeah, that's true. It's true.
So go see it. Good movie. Go see The Right Stuff again, too. Awesome movie. I love that movie.
I need to do that. I'll do that.
Yeah, I watch that every few years.
So, Carrie, you're going to start us off with the news items with some somewhat disturbing news about science communication in the U.S.
Yes. Okay. So I think the best way to approach some of the news that's been happening right now is for me to – I'm going to take off my podcaster hat and I'm going to put on my journalist hat a little bit and kind of just tell everybody what's been happening in case if they haven't been following them. Kind of across the board on Monday, we saw a slew of hiring, contract, grant, and communications freezes to some extent. And this happened at 5 different federal agencies. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, the USDA, the Environmental Protection Agency, or the EPA, the Department of Health and Human Services, the Department of Transportation, and the National Park Service. Now, much of the coverage of this, I think, fell on the USDA because there were some missteps that were made there. But there is still quite a bit of coverage about the EPA, the National Park Service, and others, and quite a bit of concern from members, or I should say individuals both within those organizations, individuals within the media, journalists, and concerned scientists as a whole. So just for a little bit of background, on Monday, an email was sent by the chief of staff for the Agricultural Research Service, the ARS, which is kind of the science arm of the USDA. And it, that email went out to the department and said that as of then, there was going to be a communications freeze, including news releases, photos, fact sheets, news feeds, and social media content. So basically anything that they consider to be forward facing to the public. It did not affect publishing research in a journal, for example, or attending a conference, but it did affect any sort of outward communication to the public. Obviously, this struck a real chord on social media. And I think that this is where you started to see a lot of concern, a lot of upset, because as of that moment, the USDA Twitter kind of ceased to tweet anything. Actually, I don't think they had tweeted anything since before the inauguration, but you did see this across some of these departments. Now, if you've been following the news, it's very minute to minute, but on Tuesday, that was rescinded by ARS Administrator Jacobs Young, and I have a quote. It says, yesterday we sent an email message about agency informational products like news releases and social media content. This internal email was released prior to receiving official departmental guidance and is hereby rescinded. I don't think anybody at this point really knows who sent word to whom and why a mass email was sent to everybody within the department before certain key figures had a chance to sign off on it. But that said, that order has been rescinded. But we're not seeing similar reports coming out of the EPA. I have a tweet here, breaking: Trump administration mandating EPA scientific studies, data, undergo review by political staff before public release. So now we're starting to see a bit of a transition. Not only is there a concern about, okay, let's not let's not publish anything for the public, any sort of data, any sort of figures, forward-facing stuff. We'll freeze being able to publish it, or okay, we can't publish it unless the administration approves the language, approves the information within it. And this is starting to sound suspiciously like what happened in Canada 6 years ago. It's starting to sound suspiciously like what a lot of people's concerns are. And one thing that I have to say that I love, just to end my little spiel on a positive note, is that there are, it's a, like 20 and counting new Twitter accounts by alternative or unofficial groups within these departments. They basically can't use the official Twitter account anymore, so they just opened up a secondary one. There's the rogue NASA, the unofficial resistance team of NASA, not an official NASA account. Follow for science and climate news and facts. Real news, real facts. There's the alt FDA. There's the alt Yosemite NPS. There's all of these different, in like, interesting alternative CDC, the quote unofficial resistance account by concerned scientists at the CDC. I don't know if you've been following on Twitter, but there was a big kind of hubbub because the National Parks Twitter account for the Badlands National Park actually defied the gag order and was tweeting really brazenly climate data facts, just like really intense, you know, this is this many parts per million, this is the level of warming, like rattling off all of these climate change facts. And it obviously got shut down and they deleted all of the tweets. But in the meantime, a lot of people were able to take screen grabs. Like, here's a good one. Today, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is higher than at any time in the last 650,000 years. Hashtag climate, hashtag facts. A lot of people are actually going and finding the secondary Twitter accounts, the unofficial Twitter accounts, and following those because the official Twitter accounts have either ceased communications or have been basically redacted when it comes to what we know to be fact, not alternative fact.
Yeah, this is it is all a little concerning, but you're right. When you say that a lot of this superficially is not different than what happens in most new administrations. For example, it's not uncommon for a new administration to put a temporary communication freeze on the departments until they all get on the same page in terms of what their messaging is going to be, et cetera. So it's a way of just, you know, getting control of the transition. Which is fine in and of itself, but the critics have said, yeah, but there seems to be a real emphasis here on science communication. This is not across the board. These really targeting the agencies that would be communicating scientific facts. And there's the backdrop here is what happened in Canada. Of course, the people that he's tapped to head these agencies, the fact that he has expressed open hostility towards the mission of a lot of these agencies, such as, you know, saying global warming is a hoax, et cetera, you know, his anti-vaccine stance. Who knows how he's going to gag the CDC? Can you imagine?
Yeah, trying to put cabinet members in place to head, you know, these are administration appointees. So to head some of these organizations, trying to nominate cabinet members who are, you know, known science deniers, like that's worrisome. We've struggled a bit in the past, right, with the House Science Committee. Lamar Smith, who is the chair of that, is a known climate denier. It's always we've always kind of just rolled our eyes or taken, you know, what's said with a grain of salt coming out of that. But I don't know if you guys remember, there's a big backlash before Trump was inaugurated. Maybe it was about 3 weeks ago. Phil Plait wrote about it on his blog on Bad Astronomy, when the House Science Committee on an official Twitter account tweeted climate denialism.
Yeah.
And it, really? I mean, it blew people out of the water because it was unprecedented. And I think that's where the real concern is coming in. It's with a kind of atmosphere of undermining of trust in independent journalists. And it is with sort of a context or a historical agenda that seems to already be a bit anti-science. These new developments contextually, I think, are a little more disconcerting than if it were just standard one administration passing it over to the other.
Yeah, the context is important here. We also have to remember that during the transition, the Trump transition team asked, I believe it was the EPA, for the names of any scientists who are doing research on global warming. Mm-hmm. And the EPA basically said, pound sand, we're not going to give it to you. And the Trump transition team backed off. But that's chilling. Can you imagine? What were they going to do with that information? Why do they need to know the names of scientists who are attending mm-hmm. conferences on global warming or whatever? The whole thing is all just a bit Orwellian. You know, if you look yes. at it across the board, this desire to control information, to criticize information that's inconvenient, that doesn't have the spin that you prefer on it. It's just, you know, it's definitely something that we have to keep a close eye on. I mean, overall, it's, you know, we talked about this when we were deciding what to talk about tonight on the show. I was like, I don't want this to become every week we're going to be talking about Donald Trump and the latest outrage or whatever. Mm. But, you know, this was above the line. I think we had to talk about this. And we're, you know, we'll try to be as fair as we possibly can, you know, we don't have a political agenda here. Yeah, we're not going to jump to any conclusions. We'll see how this plays out. This is complicated, and there's definitely multiple sides here. We'll see how it plays out. But this is definitely something, the potential here is very scary, and we need to keep a close eye on it.
Yeah. And I do think it bears mentioning, you know, I mentioned Lamar Smith, and there is a new article that was just published today as of recording. We record this on Wednesday. By Lamar Smith, who is the House Science Chairman, who was responding talking about his concerns that he doesn't think that the president is kind of getting his first week's accomplishments are being promoted by the media enough. He's not getting the press coverage that Lamar Smith thinks he deserves. So the quote is, quote, the national liberal media won't print that or air it or post it. Better to get your news directly from the president. In fact, it might be the only way to get the unvarnished truth. And kind of on its cover, it's like, oh, well, that's, you know, let's roll our eyes. It's Lamar Smith. It's very easy. But there are many people who look at somebody who is the chair of the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee, that's an authority figure. And you might not know the context of this guy denying climate science or, you know, having a political agenda that's not necessarily in line with scientific evidence, but he is in a position of authority. He is, it's powerful when he says something. And how Orwellian is it for him to say, don't trust the new liberal media. You should get your news.
Right.
And who is that source? That source is the most powerful person in the free world. These are the kinds of things that you're right, Steve. It's so important, I think, that we don't put our hands in our heads and lose our minds every 5 minutes and cry wolf and really worry. But at the same time, as protectors of science and as promoters of science and regardless of your politics, I would assume I vote science when I'm in the voting booth. That's the most important thing to me. It is important for me to not let too many little things slide, because when little things slide, that's when you find yourself in a position that, and you don't know how you got there. And that's what worries me the most.
It's all double plus good. Okay. All right. Let's move on. All right, Bob, tell us what scientists are learning from fish scales.
How much they weigh?
Yes. So forget about Iron Man armor. Think more along the lines of Aquaman fish armor.
Yeah, Aquaman.
What is that? I'll wait till you stop
Nobody
laughing.
Likes Aquaman, you know. He's like,
poor Aquaman.
Still waiting. Okay, researchers have made surprising success using fish as inspiration for protective armor. So I love biomimicry in technology and engineering. You know, why not leverage the R&D that natural selection has been doing for, you know, hello, millions of years. And lots of science, lots of engineering disciplines are being inspired by biology and nature. And that's wonderful. And this is another example. So this is exactly what researchers like Francois Barthelot of the Department of Mechanical Engineering at McGill University have been doing. Their work was released in Bioinspiration and Biomimetics. Luckily, they can still report on their scientific findings for now. What he and his colleagues were looking for was not a way to telepathically enslave fish, but for a type of protective armor that was strong and flexible at the same time, which is quite an awesome pairing of abilities. So to do this, they looked over 2 years at dozens of striped bass, but most importantly, a fish called
Wanda.
Alligator gar.
You beat me to it.
This is a fish. It's a weird-looking fish with tough scales called alligator gar. I had to look it up. It's like, what? Is that an alligator? What is that? It's not an alligator at all. It's a fish. So they basically took the scales from the fish and looked at them under a microscope, and they subjected them to forces to break and puncture to see what it would take to break and puncture them. They had this machine that had this free-falling mass with a special needle just to see. So they calculated the exact force over the surface area of the needle. So this gave them an understanding of the scale's properties and mechanics like none before, apparently. So in the end, they learned a lot about the critically important ways that scales can bend and break and slide and interact with each other, basically. So as Francois said, there's an optimum size for the scale so that it can resist puncture. There's an optimum geometry that governs how the scales interact, and there's an optimum arrangement. So what they're trying to find out is what are these optimum configurations to really make the most out of what these scales can do. So, postdoctoral fellow Roberto Martini, awesome name, by the way, said, fish scales surprised us. It may sound counterintuitive, but we discovered that smaller scales are actually more difficult to pierce than larger ones, something we can fully explain using engineering analysis. So that's interesting. The small scales are actually best to prevent piercing. So not only that, they also learned that fish scales, I didn't know this, they're the hardest or the hardiest collagen-based material that we've discovered so far. So their first application seems to be scaled gloves used in the workplace. So they seem to be focusing on these gloves. So, but what they have though is more damage resistant and flexible than when compared to an unsegmented layer of ceramic. And it's also 10 times more resistant than soft synthetic polymers. So they've already made something quite effective. So here's to biologists and engineers working together to someday turn me into a superhero. And I want to apologize a little bit to Aquaman and his fans. I was making fun of him a bit.
He has
but
fans?
I actually I reacquainted myself with his all his powers while researching this, and he is jacked. And can totally kick my ass. Did you know they rebooted? They rebooted Aquaman.
Yeah, for the
and
DC.
He is
yeah, for
badass.
The Justice League coming up.
I prefer Mermaid Man and Barnacle Boy myself.
Oh yeah, they're awesome.
There's a Mermaid rock. Man.
Oh,
gosh. Oh, Kara.
SpongeBob. Oh, Kara. Oh. All right, we got to sit down and talk, SpongeBob.
Oh. Okay, let's move on. Another bullshit acupuncture study is making the rounds. And I just wanted to talk about it briefly. This is an acupuncture for infantile colic, because why not, right? Right? I mean, you have a crying baby. Let's stick needles in them and make them cry even more. That sounds like a good idea to me. Colic basically is describes babies who tend to cry a lot. Technically, you have to cry for more than 3 hours a day, three or more days a week, for three or more weeks. Then you qualify as being colicky or having colic, infantile colic.
Oh, so it's not really like a disease state. It just means you cry a lot?
Yeah. It's a clinical syndrome. It's not really a disease.
Gotcha.
Very mysterious. You know, there's been a lot of speculation about what's actually causing it. It's one of those things where there's a lot of folk treatments for it, of course. The best treatment seems to be just cuddling your baby, holding them, consoling them. Seems to work. You know, the best, but it could be, it's very totally benign, doesn't hurt the kids, but it could be extremely exhausting for parents and caregivers. So they get desperate and they'll search for anything that can help. There's also some evidence that some kids, if you reduce or eliminate the cow's milk in their diet, then that may also help reduce the colic. But it's ripe for bogus alternative medicine or unscientific treatments. So there's only been a couple of previous studies looking at acupuncture for colic, and they were inconclusive, small, limited studies. So really no evidence to justify it. So the author set out to do a bigger, better study, but they still ended up doing a crappy study. So what they did was they had three groups, two different types of what are called minimal acupuncture, where they don't actually insert the needle to the appropriate depth. You know, in when you're doing quote unquote real acupuncture, you're supposed to insert the needles until you elicit the dikhi, which means that you've tapped into the mystical, magical energy force that the acupuncture is supposed to activate. But they said, "Ah, we don't want to hurt the kids too much, so we're just going to stick needles in a little bit. We're not going to go all the way down to where it actually does something."
Yeah, right.
And so they compared the two acupuncture groups. They compared that to no intervention. Literally, they do nothing. All the kids got usual care, you know, just whatever you would normally do. And, of course, all of the children did better in the study because they're getting the usual care. The study was only single-blinded. It wasn't double-blinded. The parents who were evaluating how the kids were doing were blinded, allegedly, but they didn't really measure how well blinded they were. That's a huge problem with acupuncture studies because it's very easy to unblind them. And if you don't do a good job of blinding or assess that, then you know it could be inadequately blinded. And there was no sham acupuncture or fake acupuncture control group. You know, placebo acupuncture, just two different types of acupuncture compared with nothing. So the results were essentially negative, but the authors reported it as positive. How do they do that? Well, the primary outcome measure that they agreed upon going in was negative. So no matter what else you say, that makes the study negative. But what they did was they did literally dozens of statistical analyses that had p-values all over the place, and they picked out some that were positive.
Oh, there you go. Classic cherry pick.
Classic p-hacking. Classic p-hacking. Mm. So that's how they do it. Then they just emphasize the comparisons that showed – and they also they couldn't show – they didn't reach statistical significance with either acupuncture group by themselves. They had to – combined, and then there was no difference between the two, but they combined them into one group, and then on some of these dozens of comparisons, you know, they eked over the 0.05 level, and just barely significant. So if you look at all the data, it's totally consistent with noise, the kind of noise that you would see with an effect that does not work. If you look at what's the probability that a p-value of 0.05 is actually reflects a real effect, it's actually pretty – or the what's the probability that's a false positive is 30%. If you – and that's something that has a reasonable prior probability. If you take something where the prior probability is pretty low, like if you think it's less than 50%, then the probability of it being a false positive jumps to like 60 to 80%. So if you do more of a Bayesian analysis where you're saying, well, how likely is it based upon this data? If we look at all this data, how likely is it that acupuncture actually works for colic? It's extremely low.
Yep.
But because they found some comparisons that eked over the 0.5 level, they reported as positive.
Oh, crap.
At the end of the day, it was just another crappy acupuncture study that was massaged to create a false positive result when technically the data was negative, and then it gets reported by the press as being positive. However, I will say that the American media reported this uncritically as showing that acupuncture works for colic.
Oh my
the
God.
British media largely reported it as controversial. And the big difference was that the British media, BBC, for example, consulted Edzard Ernst.
The
British alternative medicine expert who's actually science-based. And he was able to look at this and go, this is crap. Whereas in the United States, the journalists talk to somebody who's the director of some integrative medicine program somewhere. And of course, they're totally credulous.
Yeah,
they're totally credulous. And like, this was a rigorous study that shows that blah, blah, blah. It's bullshit. It's so disappointing. The thing is, there have been thousands of acupuncture studies, and the overwhelming pattern is completely clear. It doesn't matter where you stick the needles or even if you stick the needles. And whenever you do a properly blinded comparison, there's no difference. And the only thing that ever shows a difference are the poorly or completely unblinded comparisons. And that's consistent with placebo effect. Acupuncture is an elaborate placebo, and the evidence doesn't show anything else.
After decades, or you know, how long has the internet been around? How many years?
Decades. Yeah, since I was
12,
a kid.
12.
Yeah.
The internet or the web? The web from 93.
Right, but there is so much on the web now that somebody could find if they looked up, you know, if the journalist actually just did a little bit of research.
Yeah.
There's thousands of people out there that they could find, you know.
It's a good point, Jay. It's hard to miss. It's actually hard to miss it. I don't, you have to almost turn a blind eye to it.
Yeah, is it laziness or they don't care? Are they playing to an angle? You know,
it's but all those things. It's all those things. Or they think they're doing due diligence because they're just uninformed. They think, oh, I talked to a doctor and he said it was fine. You know, so I guess it's good. You know, they don't realize it's controversial.
Well, and it doesn't help when, like, your health insurance covers it. That's the thing. Like, a lot of insurance providers cover acupuncture. So that seems legit to somebody who doesn't think like a skeptic. And it's just like, oh, I'm just going to do something that's healthy. Well, my insurance wouldn't cover it if it weren't healthy.
Yeah, exactly. That's right, yeah. I think almost unequivocally, in my opinion, acupuncture is a pure pseudoscience that has had the best PR. Mm-hmm. It has the best, you know, narrative behind it. So I think it has the most people fooled, including doctors, because this is exactly what happens. You have these, you know, borderline studies that are technically negative, but they p-hack them and eke out a positive result, and then they get presented as being positive, and the mainstream physicians don't care enough to look at the details. The proponents lie and say it shows that it works, and then it infiltrates into mainstream medicine because people think it works. But when you actually look at the data, it doesn't work. And also, you know, not for nothing, it's magic. This is magic. They're sticking needles to alter the flow of life energy, which doesn't
exist.
Cheap points,
right? Yeah.
Yeah. And one other thing, I always have to get this out, is that this is not ancient. Acupuncture is not ancient. What is passing for acupuncture today is only about 80, 90 years old. It was a reinvention, retconning. Back, you know, what was acupuncture before that, you know, prior to the 20th century, was bloodletting. It was brutal. There was no fine little needles. They were using, right? I mean, you think a thousand years ago, they had a fine steel needle? No, these were lances. They were sticking rods in your thorax. And you know what I mean? It was
they drain
brutal.
You. They'd tap you down to zero blood. Yeah. You know, you could. They put one of those in you, and you could literally bleed to death.
Like a maple tree.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. There are
this won't
excellent.
Hurt. Clack, clack, clack.
There are excellent accounts of traditional Chinese medicine, even like in the 19th century. And it was brutal what they were doing. I mean, you know, it's not this touchy-feely, natural, whatever thing that they're pushing themselves off to be today. It was barbaric.
Yeah, now you haven't done barbaric. It like a health spa, you know, like a salon or something. It's totally
They didn't
different.
Call it acupuncture. They called it acu-stabbing.
It was astrology-based bloodletting is what it was.
Yes, but the appeal to antiquity is a is a marketing ploy. It helps sell the product.
It's an appeal to fake antiquity. It's not even
that's
real.
Right.
You know, it's not like they were
so
really doing
an extra
that.
Layer to it.
All right, Evan, are video games going to make me violent or at the very least a better soldier? They're going to allow me to shoot better.
Ooh, well, to answer that, Steve, I'm going to have to time travel with you a little bit. I have to take you back to April 30th, 2012. So this was from the Ohio State University Research and Innovation Communications Department. And there was a study. It was published in the Journal of Communication Research titled, Boom! Headshot! Effect of Video Game Play and Controller Type on Firing, Aim, and Accuracy. Here's how the Ohio State University Press described the study. They kind of boiled it down for us. Just 20 minutes of playing a violent shooting video game made players more accurate when firing a realistic gun at a mannequin and more likely to aim to hit the head, a new study found. Players who used a pistol-shaped controller in a shooting video game with human targets had 99% more completed headshots to the mannequin than did participants who played other video games, as well as 33% more shots overall that hit other parts of the body. It's the first study to show that average players using violent video shooting games with realistic human targets can improve firing, aim, and accuracy. And it was one of the co-authors of the study. His name is Brad Bushman. He's a professor of communication and psychology at Ohio State University. He said, basically, for good and bad, video game players are learning lessons that can be applied in the real world. That's the gist, pretty much. It made the headlines at the time, and a lot of people took to, say, blogging about it, including our very own Stephen Novella. who had this to say at the time. I'll quote you real quick, Steve. The quick bottom line is that the evidence is mixed and controversial. There are some correlations, but not enough to establish cause and effect. What this study is really about is training and transfer of skills from video games. It supports what common sense and prior research all indicate. Transfer of skills is optimal when the training most closely resembles the task being trained. And we've talked about that phenomenon before on the Skeptic's Guide very recently. Train your brain, brain games, and these sorts of things, so forth. These things help you with one, with a specific ability or task.
Right.
You get better one thing, right? Not, you can't expand it out further than that. At the time, not others were, say, as generous as you were, Steve, when it came to this particular study. Some independent researchers raised questions about the study. Most notable, the ones being Patrick Markey, psychology professor at Villanova University, and Mattel Elson, a behavior psychology postdoc at Ruhr University, Bochum in Germany. They began questioning the results of the study when Markey noticed some statistical inconsistencies that suggested the data was positively skewed. The debate over the findings had spilled over this boom headshot paper, whereas Brad Bushman, the co-author, had shown that video games and violent media can lead to increases in aggression and violence, but Markey believed that the opposite was true, saying the study suggests that violent video games have had little lasting effect. And as the years passed, others have chimed in as well, such as Chris Ferguson, who's the department chair of psychology at Stetson University, and he wrote a very interesting article in Skeptical Inquirer concerning how courts, our legal system, deals with studies like this when there are attempts to include them as evidence in court cases. And here's what he wrote. These studies have been rejected by every court which considers them, and with good reason. They do not prove that violent video games cause minors to act aggressively. Instead, nearly all the research is based on correlation, not evidence of causation, and most of the studies suffer from significant admitted flaws in methodology. They show at best some correlation between exposure to violent entertainment and minuscule real-world effects, such as children feeling more aggressive or making louder noises in the few minutes after playing a violent video game than, say, after playing a non-violent video game. But all that leads us to today's news concerning the Boom Headshot Study from the Journal of Communication Research, the original journal that published the study. Here's what they said. The editors of Communication Research wish to issue a retraction of the article entitled Boom Headshot, Effective Video Game Play and Controller Type of Firing, Aim, and Accuracy by Jody Whitaker and Brad Bushman. This article was first published online April 30th, 2012, and in print October 2014. This retraction is in response to inquiries from Drs. Markey and Elson, who were the two largest sort of critics and the ones who looked into it the most. And they agree, and they did this in agreement with the corresponding author, Dr. Bushman, one of the co-authors of the original study. And here's how they wrap up. A committee of initial inquiry at Ohio State University recommended retracting this article after being alerted to irregularities in some variables of the data sets by Drs. Markey and Elson in January 2015. Unfortunately, the values of the question variables could not be confirmed because the original research records were unavailable. In 2016, Drs. Markey and Elson sent their reports to Dr. Gibbs, who's one of the editors at Communication Research, who decided that a retraction was warranted, and a replication of the study by Dr. Bushman is currently in review.
Yeah.
So
they didn't have the raw data to back up their numbers, which looked dubious. There was something, you know, I guess the term irregularities is a good one. If you do a careful statistical analysis, it looks like the numbers have been cooked, which is basically what they're saying.
I'll ask you, Steve, should we be curious as the fact that the original research records became unavailable? How did that happen? It was only 4 years ago. We're not going back that far.
That's not that suspicious in and of itself because, you know, there could be massive amounts of data for studies and, you know, you can't keep it forever and they get misplaced, you know, or whatever, you know, just that, you know. Having done research and everything, yeah, you keep them for like exactly 5 years, I think is the rule. You know, not being able to produce the data within 4 years is a little questionable, but they may have thought that once the study was totally published and everything, they didn't have to keep it.
Yeah, people who have been critical of the study, at least initially, saw this as a victory, I suppose, of sorts, or a justification that this was definitely the right thing to do, to take it back, retract it.
I think that the notion that training with video games can have some transferable skills is reasonable and is consistent with the evidence, but it has to be pretty direct. Like, you have to be training at the actual thing that you're trying to do. You know what I mean?
Sure.
But the other claim that, like, playing video games makes you more violent, yeah, I'm totally not compelled by that research. It's mostly correlational.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's really no compelling evidence to conclude that.
Yeah, people used to be afraid of D&D.
Mm-hmm. I know.
You know, like, I remember telling my dad once, because he was like, I guess he just felt like it was weird, maybe. But I remember, like, Dad, would you prefer I go out drinking and driving with my friends or stay at home and play D&D? You know, and like that stopped him in his tracks because it gave him some, like, a real world comparison. But people were, like, freaked out about it.
Oh, what's funny is how nerdy D&D is. And yeah, these are people huddling around a table rolling dice. You know, it's like
using their imagination.
Exactly. Thinking too much.
But it was also, there was a lot of the religious right wrapped up in that as well, because they thought it was, mm-hmm. so they're doing witchcraft Satanic. And summoning mm-hmm. demons. Yeah.
Right. Look at the cover of this book. There's a red thing with horns on it. Ah,
so,
awful.
So where are all these summoned demons, by the way?
Oh, they're out there, Che. You don't know. They're out there faking global warming. All right, Jay, get us up to date on Who's That Noisy.
Last week I played this noisy. I left a clue in there at the end, and actually some people picked up on it. Guys, you want to take any guesses?
Well, I'm pretty sure that last week I said that if this is another talking marine mammal, I'm going to lose my shit.
So
it's so creepy, Jay.
It's cool. A listener named Tim Liff wrote in and said, this is a scuba diver talking through their regulator. Nice try and somewhat close.
Sounds like it.
But the winning guess was sent in by Chirote. And a very long last name, Pyakulworawat. So you have a wonderful last name. I can't pronounce it. This listener said, my guess is that it sounds like the whale named Nosy, spelled N-O-C, the whale that could mimic humans' voice. Yes, that is the correct answer. So this is a beluga whale, a male beluga whale who lived a pretty awesome, really incredible life. So the whale was originally captured by the U.S. Navy when he was only 2 years old, and he was trained in the late 70s to retrieve sunken experimental torpedoes in the cold waters of the Arctic. Now, according to the marine biologist Sam Ridgway, who worked with Nosy, the whales were great workers, and they formed very, very familial, intimate bonds with their trainers. And the whales actually thought of themselves as part of the team and seemed to really understand the work that they were doing very well. They were very good. They didn't have to come back. They sent the whales out to do this work, and the whales would always come back.
Well, Jay, I hope you're right. I hope you're right, Jay, because you said, you know, that this whale had an awesome life, and I'm sure it was in some ways very interesting. But I can't help but think of animals and sea creatures that are trained at these parks, and the backlash against them because they do not have a good quality of life. I mean, it sounds like these trainers really cared for these whales, and I'm sure they really did. But in terms of the quality of life that they had, I hope that, you know, they did have a good quality of life.
Well, that's what I read, Bob, and I agree. I feel the same way. I like the idea that the whales didn't have to stay, and they kept coming back. So they bonded with their trainers, and that was their family. So they kept going back to see them. So in 1984, one of the Navy divers thought he heard his supervisor give him a command underwater, and it actually was Nosy having fun. Mm-hmm. And that is very close to the recording that you heard there. You know, just him mimicking human speech in an incredibly adorable way. Now, I have a new noisy this week. I have been doing this long enough, and Evan has been doing this long enough. I may have played this one before, but There's something really cool about it, and I don't care if it's a repeat or not. I couldn't find it. You know, I did a quick lookup. Take a look. Tell me exactly what this is. Exactly what this is. I'll tell you now, that has nothing to do with marine life speaking. So that noise was sent in by a listener named Alexis De Leon. Thank you, Alexis. Very cool. If you think you know what that is or you'd like to take a guess, and if you heard anything cool this week, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. All right, Kara, what's the word?
Well, the word this week, I thought we'd go with a fun one and pick a word that is deceptively simple. So I decided to go with Adam, and not A-D-A-M, but A-T-A-O-M.
Up and at them.
Yeah.
Up and at them.
A-T-O-M. Actually, I had some friends who were trying to figure out what to name their baby, and that's what I recommended, but they didn't end up picking it. Don't you think that's Adam. A cool name? Adam, but yeah, spelled Adam. Like Atom? Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. No, okay.
Except he's going to go his entire life spelling his name because everyone's going to think it's Adam.
Yeah, that's right.
No, not like, Adam, Atom.
Adam.
I would rather be named Atom than Quark.
Yes, yeah. I agree with that. Actually, this the word this week was recommended by Stefan Gingerich from St. Anthony, Minnesota. And I love the email that he sent in. He said, while making my annual attempt to read A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, I came across the word Adam. This struck me as odd, considering the book was written in 1843. Within the first few pages of the third stave, okay, in which Scrooge is visited by the ghost of Christmas present, Dickens describes the mist on the streets on Christmas morning. Quote, the sky was gloomy and the shortest streets were choked up with a dingy mist, half thawed, half frozen, whose heavier particles descended in a shower of sooty atoms. From a little online investigation, I can't tell how commonly accepted atomic theory was in the mid-1800s, but it demonstrated to me that the concept of atoms is not as modern as I thought. So I first wanted to dig deep into the etymology, but just to make sure everybody knows what an atom is, I always like to compare Merriam-Webster and Oxford dictionary definitions. They seem to be the two best accepted ones by linguists. Merriam-Webster says that it is either the smallest particle of an element that can exist either alone or in combination, or a source of vast potential constructive or destructive energy, as referring to atomic energy or the atom bomb. Another definition is just a tiny particle, like there's not an atom of truth in what that person said. Or one of the minute indivisible particles of which, according to ancient materialism, the universe is composed. So obviously, we're dealing with this term atom to refer to something kind of similar historically for quite a long time. So let me just dig into Oxford and then we'll get into it. One, the smallest particle of a chemical element that can exist, the atom or atomic particles as a source of nuclear energy, or usually with a negative, an extremely small amount of something. Same thing, I shall not have an atom of strength left. And it, Canadian definition, usually as a modifier, a level of amateur sport, typically involving children aged between 9 and 11. 8-atom hockey teams. Have you guys heard that?
No.
Interesting, right? Weird. But anyway, when you dig deep into the etymology, you find out that we first started to see the word atom arrive in like the late 15th century. And back then, it was obviously hypothetical. And you pointed this out, Bob, off air. But yes, it means indivisible. It's a Greek word. It comes from atomos, which actually translates specifically to a, meaning not, tomos, meaning cutting or to cut. So it's uncut, it's unhewn, it's indivisible. And it's ancient. You know, we saw this in ancient Greek tomes. But then it was revived, of course, in 1805 by the British chemist John Dalton. And that's kind of the modern usage that we usually think of. But there's another cool thing about the word atom, and that's that during sort of medieval eras, the atom was a unit of time. Did you guys know this?
No, Jesus. No. And,
time?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one of the earliest references to that is actually in the Bible. In the New Testament. In 1 Corinthians 15:52, it says, en atomo en repe ophthamu, which actually means like the time needed for the twinkling of an eye. It's referring to an atom, meaning like kind of a moment. And if you look through That's a cool. series of texts coming from there, people have defined what an atom actually translated to. So some people would say that it was 1/564th of a momentum. At the time, a momentum was about 1.5 minutes. So it equaled to 1594ths of a second. Like, there are all these really interesting ways that atom was used as a definition of time before we had modern clocks and kind of what we think of now as a more modern way to keep time. So pretty interesting that this pretty simple term referring to what we, of course, now know is divisible, but thought for a long time was indivisible, can refer to so many things.
Atomism goes back to the 5th century BCE with Leucippus.
Mm-hmm. Super. Leucippus. Super
I think that's
old.
How you pronounce it.
Yeah, Leucippus. All right, thanks, Kara. Well, guys, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. There is a theme this week, and there are 4 items.
Uh-oh.
The theme is extinct species. So 3 of these are actual species that went extinct because of human activity, and 1 is made up. There's something fictitious about one of them, but the other 3 are correct. Are you ready? How much do you know about extinct animals?
Uh-oh.
They're not extant.
Right. They're not extant. Here we go. Item number 1. The great auk was a large flightless seabird resembling a penguin, but living in the North Atlantic. It was driven to extinction by overhunting in 1844. Item number 2. The swift fox was driven to extinction in the 1930s as part of a deliberate program of predator control in the United States. Item number 3, the golden toad was a common species in Costa Rica, but its population steadily declined with the last sighting in 1989. This was the first species extinction blamed on global warming, but later evidence has cast doubt on that conclusion. And item number 4, the Zanzibar leopard once inhabited the Zanzibar archipelago in Tanzania, but was deliberately hunted to extinction because they were thought to be the servants of witches. All right, Bob, go first.
See, I knew it because I said something. I always say, don't talk, Bob, don't. The great auk, whatever. I have no idea. It sounds plausible. I mean, really, this is just flipping a damn coin. The swift fox, that one, just seems like 1930s, United States, a type of fox. I think I would have heard about that. So that one got my attention early. The golden toad, whatever. Who knows? Costa Rica. I mean, maybe sounds, nothing's leaping out. A Zanzibar leopard. All right. I got a leopard because thought to be, the servants of, so, was it black? Is a leopard black by definition? Oh shit, I don't remember. But, oh, you got this big, I'm thinking it's black, but it might not be. But you got this big cat, servants of witches? I don't know. I think that one might be definitely made up just because we think little cats are servants of witches. You know, a big black cat? That's a bit of a reach. But I could be totally wrong about the black. Whatever. I'm just going to pick. It's either 2 or 4. Yeah, I guess I could have missed the swift fox thing, but yeah, I'll go with the Zanzibar leopard. Fiction.
Okay, Kara.
Unlucky for you. I just recently read The Sixth Extinction. And also one of my best friends is a conservation wildlife reporter. So I read a lot of things that he writes, which makes me pretty confident that the great auk and the golden toad are extinct and that they are extinct the way that you wrote about them being extinct or the way that you described them being extinct. Yeah, like the great auk looks like a big old penguin, if I'm remembering correctly. and the golden toad, there's, you know, bad, a lot of amphibian decline within the last few decades. And this, I think, I mean, unless I'm mixing up, it's a different type of toad, but I think it's one of many, actually, that either went extinct or is critically endangered in that part of the world. So I'm kind of with Bob. It's either the swift fox or the Zanzibar leopard, but I'm leaning the other way because in my mind, I'm thinking, and again, I could be mixing it up, but I'm thinking the swift fox is like not even, like it's everywhere. Like I think it's a pretty common animal. So I'm going to, if unless I'm mixing up the type of fox, that's an American animal that we run into a lot. The Zanzibar leopard, who freaking knows? That sounds like fiction. It was hunted to extinction because they were thought of to be the servants of witches. Jesus. But you know what? I'm just going to go with my gut because last time that screwed me and I'm going to say that, or it didn't. It screwed me not to. I'm going to say the swift fox is alive and kicking.
Okay, Jay.
Well, the only one that I'm 100% sure existed was the golden toad. Steve,
the rest are all made up.
Could have. I hope that whichever one, whichever one is the fake, Steve did make up. Without going through all of them, I'm agreeing over here with Kara. I think the swift fox one is the fake.
Okay, and Evan.
Oh gosh, I have no idea about any of these. Terrible. I should know about one of these, and I don't.
Make up some alternate facts.
Yes. Oh, I could do that easily. So I'll just have to say I'll go with
Come on, Evan, join us.
Yeah, fine. I'm getting peer pressure over here, Steve. Help me.
No peer pressure. Yeah, Steve, help him.
Steve, help me here.
Can't help.
We don't know what we're talking
about. Help me, Bob.
All right, the gravity of two people is stronger than the gravity of one. Sorry, Bob. I'll go swift fox. Fiction.
Okay. That means you all agree that the great auk was a large flightless seabird resembling a penguin but living in the North Atlantic. It was driven to extinction by overhunting in 1844. All think that one is science, and that one is science. That is correct. The great auk resembled a giant penguin, as I believe Kara said.
That's adorable.
Yeah, very, very agile in the water. Very, very not agile on land.
Aw, is that why they got killed so easily?
Yeah, so they were hunted. You know, the sailors, they had valuable meat and feathers, so they were hunted for their meat and feathers. The story of how the last few were killed is like chilling. The last one was there was a mated pair on Eldie Island, and some men were fishermen saw them and said, "Hey, the last two auks, let's go kill them."
How did they know these were the last two?
They didn't, but you know, they might as well. They chased them down and caught them and killed the birds. And in the process, they stomped on and destroyed the last egg, killing the race.
What a bunch of dumb apes. I mean, come on. Yeah. Can't we do better than this? Is this the kind of, how about bringing this, the species back, you know? They're talking about de-extinction of other animals, and I think that's fascinating, and, you know, why not?
Yeah.
If we could,
If we could. Do we have enough DNA lying around from these things?
Yeah, it seems like in these frozen tundra places. I mean, if there's a frozen example of one somewhere, maybe.
Wow. Yeah, so the great auk was very similar to the dodo. They were just pretty helpless on land and were easy pickings, big chunks of meat, so...
Jeez.
They were described as looking more like a Dr. Seuss cartoon than a penguin, really. Aww, they
were there stars on ours?
They were cute. Okay, you guys all also agree that the golden toad was a common species in Costa Rica, but its population steadily declined with the last sighting in 1989. This was the first species extinction blamed on global warming, but later evidence has cast doubt on that conclusion. All think that one's science, and that one is science.
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
Now we're 50-50.
Yeah, you're 50-50. So, they were officially declared extinct in 2005.
I mean, not yay for the golden toad being extinct, but
yeah. And so what happened was that this is why they thought it was due to global warming, because as the tropical environment in which it lived was getting warmer and drier, that was allowing certain fungal species to proliferate, and the toads were getting, not just this species, as you said, Kara, but other species as well, coming down with these horrible fungal infections that were killing them. Mm. So they said, okay, well, there you go. Global warming, drier, fungus, killing the toads. But then a recent study that was published in Science, this was just published in 2010, they did the first real wood sampling to, you know, in tropical areas, the trees don't make rings like they do in the more temperate zones because there's no winter, you know. Mm-hmm. But you have to do a more sophisticated analysis. You have to analyze the oxygen isotopes, and that could tell you if that will be different between a dry and wet season. And so
– Wabbit season.
Yeah. So you could tell the alternating dry and wet seasons can tell you how many years. So with that, they were able to estimate the temperature back, you know, a few hundred years in that area. And when they did that, they said, yeah, it looks like the dry and the wet seasons are affected mainly by the El Nino cycle. And that's overwhelming any background overall warming trend, at least in that data. So they said, therefore, it might have been more just El Nino dry cycle, you know, that ended up killing off the toads. Then, of course, you have to ask, well, why now? You know, because El Nino cycle has been around for a long time. So I think that's probably an open question. I think is that the new study cast doubt on the conclusion, didn't necessarily absolutely disprove it. I think now it just moved it to the controversial level.
Well, I do recommend that's the one that was the most obvious to me, because I did recently read that book, The Sixth Extinction by Elizabeth Colbert. It came out in 2014. It's really good. And she does a whole chapter on these tropical frogs and kind of how they're a big indicator for a lot of other things that are happening. But I highly recommend it if you haven't read it yet. It's just really good natural science and climate change and, yeah, Anthropocene stuff.
Have you guys seen a picture of the golden toad? The thing is gold. It looks like not just like yellow.
Yeah, it's adorable.
It looks gold. Very, very pretty. Okay, but they're gone. Gone forever.
Aww, so sad.
So let's see, which one should we go to now? Let's go back to number two. The swift fox was driven to extinction. Did not jump over the lazy brown dog, by the way. Was driven to extinction in the 1930s as part of a deliberate program of predator control in the United States. Evan, Jay, and Kara think this one is the fiction. Bob thinks this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
Kara, you did it.
Yes. So does that mean, am I wrong? Are they not even extinct?
They're not extinct. So the swift fox was, the population did plummet in the 1930s because of a deliberate program of predator control in the United States. They were trying to reduce the population of foxes and coyotes and wolves. So all three, you know, predators were, their populations were decreased, but then they were too successful. And then the swift fox specifically got put on the endangered species list, and it's made a huge rebound. So the population has come back significantly. So now it's doing just fine. And I think it was taken off the endangered species list.
Didn't we do another science or fiction about another species that got decimated?
Black-footed ferret.
That's fascinating.
All of that means that the Zanzibar leopard, once inhabited the Zanzibar archipelago in Tanzania, but was deliberately hunted to extinction because they were thought to be the servants of witches, is science.
Wow, that's insane.
Yeah, the local belief, where they thought that witches summoned them and then would like send them against their enemies to kill them. And these are big cats. These are leopards. They're beautiful too. I mean, they're, you know, because they're leopards, but they're different, you know, than what you might think of when you think of a leopard, because they're a different species. They have lots of little, they're like tawny colored with lots of little dark brown spots. The Zanzibar Museum apparently has a mounted specimen. Hmm. You can find a picture of that. But yeah, terrible, right? Just because of superstition, the government even got involved. Like, it wasn't just the locals, you know.
Ooh, that mounted specimen is not pretty. That is some bad taxidermy.
Yeah, that's
rough.
But the coloring and everything, you can see it's kind of. Yeah. I love big cats. Big cats are adorable to me.
Me too.
Yeah.
They're so, you know, they call it charismatic megafauna for a reason. Like, they're such a good example of that.
Yeah. There was a combined anti-witchcraft and leopard killing campaign.
Oh my God.
Was successful, unfortunately.
Of course there was. Yeah.
So sad. Well, That's that misinformation. Everything. It's so detrimental.
Everything's a wish over there.
Yeah. Seriously.
You know, I wanted to include a species that went extinct because their body parts were being used in alternative medicine, but I think you guys know all about those, so I didn't want to use them. Like tiger bones and bear gallbladders and rhino horns, right? Yeah. So, but I thought that would be too obvious. Like the one that's actually gone extinct is the West African black rhino.
The black rhino, yeah.
God, really?
So sad. Awful. Yeah, so sad. Is it only extinct in the wild? Do we have any in captivity?
No,
or is it,
totally
it's just gone. That's so sad.
Hope we got their DNA.
Yeah, but what's the point of bringing these back to an environment that can't sustain them? It's sad. If we couldn't keep them alive back then, why could we keep them alive once we decide to de-extinct?
It's good to know we can eventually.
So yeah. 2006 was the last sighting of a West African black rhino.
We've all seen rhinos. Most of us have seen rhinos in those parks. They are magnificent.
They're
massive
God. Creatures.
White rhinos?
Massive.
Yeah. They're beautiful.
Any of them were just like, whoa, look at that massive flesh.
Mm-hmm. So here's a couple of runner-ups. You guys are familiar with Lonesome George? You guys ever hear of Lonesome George?
I saw Lonesome George. Well, I saw, you know, he's stuffed now or like his shell or whatever.
Yeah.
Because he died. He died pretty recently.
2012. The last Pinta Island tortoise. The tortoises also, because they're big and slow, but also, interestingly, they can go a long time with very little food and water. So they basically were portable, you know, food stores for ships.
Yeah,
bring them onto your ship. They'll be alive. You don't have to feed them or really give them water. They'll survive for a long time, and you kill them when you want to eat them.
Oh,
and they're just
gosh.
Big bags of meat.
Terrible.
But that sounds horrible.
And it's so interesting. I mean, the Galapagos tortoises are almost, if not more interesting than the finches.
Oh, yeah.
They're so specific to the individual islands. And then there was some interbreeding and some didn't. And then there's breeding programs. But Lonesome George, like you said, he was the last of them. And they have different shapes and sizes. You can really see them. Like, I don't know. If you ever get to go to the Galapagos, I urge you to go to the Darwin Research Center because you can see their cool tortoise breeding program.
There was also the Javan tiger. Driven to extinction by deforestation. Yeah, so basically in the 1970s is when they did it. Very sad. So you have to wonder, like 50 years from now, 100 years from now, what are going to be the species that they're talking about that went extinct, like the elephant?
Oh, you know, sure.
It is scary.
Bear.
It's scary to think about, you know, the animals that we're going to lose.
Absolutely. Like there are things that, you know, are common.
Yeah, we are in the middle of a massive extinction. It's already happening.
Yeah, we just don't recognize it as much because the vast majority of species on the planet are insects. So when we're losing insects and small like herps, like lizards and things like that, or birds, like we don't notice as much, but we're losing species left and right. It's horrible. It's just we only seem to be. It only seems to make the news when it's a mammal, which is interesting.
We're mammal centric.
What was the one, the thylacine? Is that what it was called? You guys remember the thylacine?
Yeah.
It was like a marsupial, I think, or something. No.
Tasmanian tiger.
Tasmanian tiger. Yeah. Those were cool.
Thylacines, yeah.
Yeah. Also, like, kind of recent. Like, there's actual photographs of them.
Yeah, that's like 100 years ago now, something like that. Early 20th century, I think, is when they went extinct. Occasionally, people think that they've sighted them, but...
Mm-hmm. Gotta love crypto. Yeah. Zoology. Yeah.
And then my favorite, is it extinct or have people seen it, is the ivory-billed woodpecker.
Yeah.
Yeah, which
I saw one of those.
No,
I'm just kidding.
I saw a picture of one of those.
Last sighting was in like the 1920s. Last confirmed sighting. These were like in the swamplands of the South. But there have been a couple of dubious sightings recently. But pictures that are like, yeah. Because the thing is, because the pileated woodpecker is the same size. The field markings are similar, but there are some differences. So if you have a blurry picture or a blurry video of a pileated, you could convince yourself that it's an ivory billed. Nothing definitive, nothing that would end scientific debate. So it's still officially extinct. But, you know, the thing is, there's the deep swamps. There absolutely could be an ivory-billed woodpecker hiding in there that no one's seen for decades. There's enough wilderness there that it's plausible. It's plausible. It'd be cool. Be totally cool if there was a confirmed sighting. But, you know, 70-plus years is a long time to go without any sightings. You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, that was depressing.
There's not many of them if they're still left. There are not many of them, but they're probably extinct, unfortunately. Well, good job, guys. Bob, you're off to a rocky start again, but that's okay. It's early in the year. Don't get discouraged. Did make you go first this week. I didn't know Kara was a ringer this week. I would have made her go later.
Evan, I pulled you in, man. I had a feeling.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
The Constitution of India, Section 51A, states, "It shall be the duty of every citizen of India to develop the scientific temper, humanism, and the spirit of inquiry and reform. Our aim at the Indian Rationalist Association is to encourage and support people to fulfill this very duty." Written by, or actually spoken in an interview by, Sanal Edamaraku.
Sanal. I love that.
Yeah, we've
That's
had him
great.
On the show before. He's a good friend of Skeptics Everywhere, Indian author and rationalist, founder and president and editor of Rationalist International, and the president of the Indian Rationalist Association, the author of 25 books and other articles.
25? Jeez.
That's impressive.
For he's which he was hunted out of India, you know, through death threats.
A true fighter. Yep. Yeah, he's got death threats on right now. That's why he can't return back to his country.
Charged by a group of Catholics there with blasphemy. Because he examined a so-called miracle at a church, and they ran him out of the country.
Yeah, the miracle was it was sewage water and not the blood of Christ.
Yeah, people were anointing themselves with it. Everything was sewage. It was sewage. Ugh. It was literally sewage. Good job. Okay, well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Roger
Thanks,
that.
Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.